Okay, welcome everyone. This is the third lecture for Principles of Economics, the winter 2011 edition of the course. And we've got a lot of material to cover tonight. And for those of you who have just joined us, let me say one last time that for this lecture, and particularly at the tail end of it, it will be very useful if you have either your physical textbook next to you for reference or go grab the PDF that's been posted here in the public chat box and have pull that up and get it ready, because at the end of this lecture I'm going to talk about the candy bar example and go through those tables and make sure you guys really understand the logic, you know, that you first of all know how to read those charts, but then also that you understand the logic behind where I come up with the different price ratios of Snickers for Milky Ways. So my talk will make a lot more sense if you can see the thing clearly. And if you're just looking at the PowerPoint on DimDim, it's going to be hard to make out. So it's around page 86 if you want to, you know, get that ready while we're still going over the stuff in the beginning here. Other than that, I am broadcasting from a hotel room in Birmingham. I got a talk tomorrow, and so I'm here for this conference. So thank you for everyone who juggled your schedules around to accommodate me. I think I'll have to do this too much for the rest of our course. Maybe one other time I would need to go look at my calendar, but it shouldn't happen too much. So thank you for your understanding and being able to rearrange your schedule. So one last thing pertaining to that is I'm not sure when this week's quiz will be posted. I mean, it should be posted by tomorrow. Well, actually, since we're doing it a day early, it'll be fine. Never mind. I take that back. The quiz isn't ready to go right now, but we're a day ahead of time, so it doesn't matter. So forget that. The week three quiz will be ready when it otherwise would have been ready. Okay, so you can see what we're going to be going over tonight is talking about private property, the different institutional settings, and then we're going to go into direct exchange. Okay, so private property. Here, this is something, again, I think I said this in the beginning of the course, but let me repeat it. As many of you know, I'm affiliated with what's called the Austrian School of Economics. But in this course, in the textbook that I wrote, The Lessons for the Young Economist, it's not an Austrian book. Okay, it's supposed to just be a general introduction to economics. And of course, since I personally think that the Austrian school is the most useful or the one that has the best insights, naturally the stuff that I'm writing about for is an introductory text tends to be Austrian in flavor, but strictly speaking it's just general economics, and I think a lot of free market economists, whether or not they were Austrians, would endorse the stuff that I've got in there. But this area of why do we have private property, I mean, that's something, again, that even though general free market economists reading the book or hearing this lecture I think would endorse everything I said, this is an area in terms of contributions to economic thought where the Austrians really shine, that in particular Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek were crucial in the early 20th century with their critiques of socialism, and that they really upped the ante, if you will, that it was more than the original critique, like back in the 18th century, the 19th century, the late 1800s, when, you know, socialism was in vogue among intellectuals, you know, and sort of conservative types would oppose it. I mean, one of the arguments would typically be things like the conservatives would say, well, you know, no one's going to have the incentive to work hard if the government takes everything that's produced and puts it in a common pot and then divides it up. That if you're only getting, you know, 1/100 millionth of the total output, regardless of how much you personally put into it or not, well, then you're going to have the incentive to just, you know, slouch back and just shirk. And so that was one of the big critiques of socialism. And that's probably true. That is a valid critique, and that probably does accurately describe most people in the real world. And so, yeah, that fact alone would be probably a crushing blow to a socialist system, at least a system that was going to be imposed on all of humanity, as opposed to, like having people voluntarily go and join some little commune somewhere. But in response to that, the socialists just said, well, yeah, people right now are very acquisitive and greedy and only interested in themselves, and they'll only work for their narrow self-interest, but that's because they've been raised in this horrible system of capitalism. And that in under capitalism, if you don't go out there and engage in cutthroat competition and so forth, then you starve to death. So it's not surprising that the people who grow up in this horrible system end up being brutalized. You know, just to make an analogy, like if someone grew up in a world where there were rampaging gangs going around beating people up and so on, the people who were 50 years old in that world would probably be really violent. And, you know, if you went up to them and started twapping their ear, they'd probably kill you or something. Okay, so, but it would be wrong to therefore conclude that, oh, human nature is such that if you go up and mess with somebody, they kill you, because you could say, no, the reason people are like that is because they've grown up in this really violent system. So that's what the socialists were saying about the conservative critiques of socialism, that, you know, you're seeing man as he's been brutalized by capitalism, and that if people grew up in a socialist paradise, then they wouldn't, you know, if you had all of your material, if you knew your material wants would be provided for whether or not you went and really sweated 16 hours a day in the factory, then, you know, you wouldn't be worrying about material things, and then you would be happy just, you know, as part of your, you know, how can you contribute, how can you help? You would want to go help and work and do whatever the community thought, you know, you had your niche in terms of contributing. Okay, so that was kind of how the arguments were going until Mises comes along. And Mises pointed out that look, without market prices and the institution of private property, there's just the socialists wouldn't know how to use resources properly. Right? So it wasn't just an issue of incentives, it was an issue of how do we know what to do with society's scarce resources. And Mises pointed out that, you know, under capitalism, under the market economy, institution of private property, this problem is solved every day sort of automatically or spontaneously through the price system. Right? So that's the context of the sorts of things we're going to be looking at in this course. And again, the insights that I'm going to be giving you guys are largely coming from the Austrian school, even though I'm not going to label it the, you know, Austrian points, because they're more general. So back to this slide, why do we have private property in the first place? Well, the main reason is just from a, I guess, like a sociological point of view, is that once you have more than one person, you're going to start to have conflict. All right. So before, we went over the Robinson Crusoe world, all right, and we analyzed economic principles or concepts that you can spin out from or deduce from the action axiom or the premise of action or the viewpoint that you're saying people are acting. And we saw you could deduce a surprising number of things just from your decision as the analyst to interpret what's going on as another mind at work. Okay, so specifically in the Robinson Crusoe context, we did in the last lecture, is we just went through and saw an individual interacting with nature. What sorts of things can we say about that person if we think he's using his reason to try to achieve objectives or goals? And there's a lot of things there that sound very economic, like costs and benefits and things like that, and capital goods and consumption goods and labor. All those concepts we can define and deploy in that setting of just one person interacting with the natural world. So one thing we didn't have to worry about there was what happens if there's a conflict over how those resources are used, right? Because the only intelligent being there was Robinson Crusoe in that setting we considered last time. So there was still a conflict in the sense that maybe some of his goals conflicted with each other. Like on the one hand, he would have liked to just lounge around on the beach all day and take a little swim in the ocean and then come back and eat some coconuts. And on the other hand, he didn't want to starve to death. And so those are kind of in conflict, right? That he doesn't want to work, he doesn't want to spend all day climbing trees and grabbing coconuts, but on the other hand, he doesn't want to starve. And so just given the natural reality, there is a conflict there. So if you want to interpret it and say it's like he's butting heads with nature, you know, you can do it that way if you want to, but nature always wins in the sense that those are the that's the reality you face, and you can't change that. But the point is, within those natural trade-offs, you know, he could choose the trade-off that suits him best. So he's not going to work 24 hours a day, but on the other hand, he's not going to work 0 hours per day. All right, and he's not going to starve to death, but on the other hand, he's not going to just, you know, eat as many coconuts as he would if they were just falling off the trees by themselves, and he could just have his fill and not have a care in the world about what it takes to get more, right? So he's going to eat somewhere in between those two numbers, and the same thing, he's not going to work as if leisure means nothing to him, but he's also not going to lounge around as if work is pointless. Okay, so now when you introduce other people, which is what we're going to be doing in this chapter, or this lecture, you have an added complication. So each person is using the same principles or is illustrating the same principles that we talked about with Crusoe, but now I've got an added twist that what happens if you are looking at the coconuts on the tree and you're trying to decide, okay, yeah, I think I'll eat five of them today and then I'll save the other four for tomorrow, and that's the mental plan that you're concocting. And so you're coming up with a plan for how you're going to use the resources at your disposal. But what if the guy down the block, so to speak, on the other side of the hill, is looking at the same coconut tree? And he's thinking, well, let's see, I'll grab all those and put them in my stockpile because tomorrow I'm going to start building a pole and I'm going to need to consume them tomorrow. And he's doing the same thing. Obviously, that can't work, right? At least one person's going to not be able to do that if they both got incompatible aims or designs on the same physical resources. All right, so that's why you need to have some sort of institutional setting at all. That's what institutions in terms of property, that's what they do, or at least that's one of the things they do, is they provide a way of specifying or determining who gets to decide what happens to particular resources. Because you need some way of determining it. All right, so in the book, I outline three main categories of institutions in terms of how do you deal with solving these problems, these conflicts. So how do we determine, of all the scarce resources we have that people might want to use to obtain their objectives, how do we figure out which person gets priority over them? All right, so the first one we're going to go over is what's called capitalism or the market economy. And I should point out to you guys that some people don't use those terms interchangeably. Some people, right now, even among libertarians or some groups of libertarians, it's becoming fashionable to say that you're against capitalism. Okay, that they're saying, no, I believe in the free market. And actually, they say the freed, ending with a D, the freed market, and they say that they hate capitalism, but if you like read more about their worldview, you'll see they're what, you know, they believe most of what Ludwig von Mises or Murray Rothbard would believe. Okay, so what they're doing is they're trying to say that they oppose right now what most people think of as capitalism in terms of giant corporations that are in league with the government and get all sorts of, you know, special privileges and have the government levy all sorts of regulations to cripple their smaller competitors. And, you know, maybe, you know, the real big ones might be operating factories overseas and have the local governments there making people basically perform slave labor and all that kind of stuff. Or especially like arms manufacturers who might, you know, literally be getting money from the government in order to have people get blown up and that kind of stuff. So you can see there's a lot of people that would be classified as leftists who are very suspicious of giant corporations. And so a lot of current libertarians, to try to let those people know that, hey, it's not that we're for big corporations, we're for free exchange and true property rights, they will go out of their way to say, oh no, I don't believe in capitalism, because they think that the term capitalism for a lot of people on the left means giant corporations in bed with the government. And so they're saying, oh no, we're not for that system. Okay, so I just want to clarify for you, in this class and in my textbook, of course, when I talk about capitalism, I don't mean the system right now that's in existence in the United States or in Europe. When I say capitalism, I mean a market economy where, you know, there's no, the government's not interfering with the competitive process and things like that. All right, so I just want to make sure you understand that. Yes, I see Susie asks a question in the public chat saying, these institutional settings provide the framework or the set of rules under which the exchanges are made, correct? And that's right. So these three different broad categories are all different ways that humans can solve this problem that I said, that there's this this potential conflict over how do we use scarce resources, because we've got only so many resources to go around, and people have a lot of different objectives or preferences or goals that could use those resources to assist them, and there's not enough to go around, right? It can't be the case that every single person gets to do everything he or she could possibly want to do with physical scarce resources, because something's got to give. And so the question is, how do we determine who gets it and who doesn't, okay? And so, yeah, these are all different ways of doing it. So capitalism, what I mean by that term in this course and in the textbook, I use it interchangeably with market economy or free market, or what's sometimes called laissez-faire, or what's also called a free enterprise system. All right, so those, at this level of analysis for you guys, I'm using those terms interchangeably, and I'm just warning you that some people might make real fine distinctions and say that they're not interchangeable, but for our purposes in this course, they are interchangeable. And that just means a system where everything that's a scarce resource is property, and it's assigned to a specific owner or owners. Okay, so everything is owned by somebody, and that's what we mean by a pure market economy. And now there can be cases where multiple people own something. For example, you can have 1,000 people all owning a certain corporation, but there, I mean, strictly speaking, what's happening is each person owns like a portion of it, and in principle the person could sell his rights to somebody else, and so like the other owners could buy out the person. Okay, so that's what we mean. And then within that setting, so if you are the owner of a resource, you are the person that has the ultimate legal decision-making power. So when we say, hey, there's some coconuts here and Jim wants to use them, he wants to consume them today, but John down over there over the hill wants to save them for tomorrow because John has a plan for, he's going to build a pole and he needs to eat coconuts tomorrow, and he had his eye on those coconuts. Who gets to decide? You would say, well, who's the owner of those coconuts? Who does the legal system say is the rightful owner? And then you go ask that person, what do you want to have done with them? And notice that the owner could be neither of those persons. The owner might be Sally, who lives 10 miles away. And you say to Sally, what do you want to do? And maybe John is, or what did I say, Billy? I forget which names I said, but maybe the guy who lives over the hill, maybe that's her son. And she says, yeah, he can use them. That's fine. You see, so it's not that under capitalism or market economy, everyone's real greedy and says, no, I get to do what I want with my thing, and you can't, no one else can. I mean, you can be very generous and share it, and if you're a parent in particular, a lot of the property that's legally yours, you're going to allow your children to use, like even just like your teenager hopping in the car and going to the store, it might technically be your property, your car, but you say, yeah, that's fine, I'll give him my permission to do that. Okay, but the point is, how do we know whether your teenager's stealing the car or not? It's whether the owner, who happens to be you maybe in this case, whether you gave permission to do that. Okay, so that's how things are determined there. And not just even with sort of personal household items like an automobile, but also, you know, how do we determine on this piece of land if there's going to be a shopping mall or if there's going to be a farm or if there's going to be a factory? Well, again, you just say, well, who owns the land? And then that's the person who ultimately gets to decide. Now, we'll see as we go all through the course, when you talk like that to somebody who has no idea at all about economics, that sounds like a crazy system. It sounds like you're just asking for chaos. And that's exactly what socialists historically thought, that the market economy they thought was anarchy in the pejorative sense of the word, that how could it possibly be? You've got all these millions of people running around who all own little bits of the whole structure, and there's no organization, they thought. That how can, you know, that's insane. You're telling me this guy over here who owns this little plot of farmland, it's totally up to him whether we grow food or not on that land. And, you know, if he wants to, he can just build a big inflatable slide and just be going down the slide all day. And that's how we're going to use that valuable farmland. That's nuts. He shouldn't have the power to do that, because maybe people are hungry and we need to use that land to plant some oranges or something to feed these hungry people. All right, so that's the a very crude, someone who has no conception about how a market economy works, that might be the reaction to me describing a laissez-faire property rights system. But of course, we'll see as we go through the course that, well, no, there's all sorts of mechanisms through which people's desires get transmitted or communicated among each other. So the person who owns that piece of land that could be very useful in growing crops will see the market prices and will realize, well, yeah, I have the legal right. I could just put up a giant inflatable slide and ride it all day, but I won't earn money. You know, no one's going to pay me to do that. Whereas if I start growing oranges and selling them, or if I lease my land, rent it out to some farmers, or if I sell it to some big agricultural company, I'm going to have a lot more money, and maybe I'll go buy some land out in the wilderness that's not very arable, and that's where I'll build my slide. Because it doesn't matter to me where the slide is, but for people who want oranges, this particular plot of land is very productive. Okay, so that's the way things work. So it's ironic that the socialists actually, they have two objections to capitalism, but they don't realize that the objections sort of cancel out. If they just understood how a market works. Because on the one hand, the socialists think, oh, this is a crazy system. There's no order. There's no way to sort of coordinate everyone's activities so that the people growing oranges are sort of in concert with the people who are driving tractor trailers delivering produce to the grocery store, right? That there seems to be no relationship in capitalism. Everyone does whatever they want. And then at the same time, though, the socialists say, and what a horrible system where people just do things not for the common good, but they do it for money. What a disgusting system. But without seeing that, no, that's the way you bring about the coordination is through money prices. And that's how people know, wait a minute, this plot of land is more urgently needed to grow oranges than for me to put my inflatable slide on. All right, so I'm sort of getting ahead of ourselves. We'll do all this stuff later on in the course, but I'm just giving you the broad outline. So that's what capitalism, the market economy is, and that's what we're going to spend some time on in the textbook and then, of course, in this course, going through, and that's what we'll be describing. So let me just mention one last thing. For the purposes of giving you a pure, simple introduction, when we start out in this and we start going through how would a market work, we're not going to have any government at all. All right, so that, I'm not saying that because I think that's a model of the real world. Obviously, right now there is no society, nor has there ever been one where there was a pure private property market system with no government intervention. Right, that's never existed, and it's not likely to exist anytime soon. So, but the reason we're starting with that, again, it's sort of like starting with the Robinson Crusoe. Before we start analyzing how does government cause things to be different, or how does government influence things, it's easier conceptual if we start from a baseline and look at, well, what if there were no government? What if it were just pure market forces? What would things be like? And then we can say, okay, now let's bring in the government and see how that changes things. So one problem with that, that even a lot of free market people would have, is they would say, well, without a government, how are property rights respected? Right? It doesn't make sense to start talking about voluntary trades where you only can grab somebody's coconuts if the owner agrees to that. that what if people go around stealing stuff? Like, don't you need some agency that enforces the property rights? So we're going to not worry about that. There, if you're interested in that stuff, you know, in the office hours, you want to ask me, there's plenty of things that Austrian economists and other libertarians have written on, you know, could a free market provide police and judicial services and stuff like that. But that's way too complicated for what we're doing in this course. All right, so I'm just going to ignore that issue. And for our purposes, we'll just assume, for whatever reason, that people obey the property rights and that there's no crime, and that we're just going to look at voluntary market trades and see what we can say about those sorts of settings. Okay, the next major institutional arrangement is socialism, or what's called the command economy. So there, the idea is, rather than have all the property split up into small pieces and owned by various individuals, and that you need to get the consent of the owner before you can use a particular piece of property, under socialism, in principle, everything is all owned by one central group, whether it's, you know, depending on your vision of the socialist world, it could be a group of elders who are very wise and the community just defers to them, or it could be a formal government apparatus, or it could be one person, it could be like a dictator or something, all right? But in terms of this, the general social structure, the idea is that one person or one group of experts comes up with the grand master plan for how resources will be used, and then tells everybody else what to do. And that's how it works. And now, in practice, historically, there are all sorts of different variants of socialism. So, for example, like real, I would say, purist socialists would say, no, in principle, the government can tell you, you know, what your job is, because your labor is part of the means of production, right? Your body, your labor power, is a scarce factor that contributes to the output every year. And so if you're going to say the government controls all the farmland and controls all the factories and the tractors and the fertilizer and the copper mines, well, then it would be inconsistent to say the government also isn't in control of all the labor, because labor is the most important, or one of the most important inputs into production. So the government needs the power to be able to tell, you know, okay, you heart surgeons, you're going over here. And you truck drivers, we need you over here. And you guys who can dig ditches, we need you over here. And if those people complain and say they don't want to move, well, that's tough. Just like, the you know, if the farmland complained and said we don't want there to be a factory built here, the planner would say, well, that's too bad. Okay, so the same thing. But also, some socialist theorists historically wouldn't have said that. They would say, no, we can allow workers to do what they want to do. And I think actually that, you know, there's sort of a contradiction there, but I'm just letting you know that it wasn't like there was one monolithic vision of how the socialist society would work. Another nuance would be, a lot of socialists didn't actually think that every single piece of property would be owned by the state. That some of them thought that workers would be able to keep ownership of, like, the tools of the trade. So if you were a skilled, like a carpenter or something, the actual, like the hammer and the saw and the stuff that you used in your day-to-day work, that could be yours. Or like if you were a painter, obviously all that stuff, the brushes and whatever, that would all be yours. That you would have that, and so that would, you could think of that as your property. And so that when those socialists talked about the government controlling what they would say the means of production, they didn't have in mind every last little piece of equipment and tool in the whole community. They were thinking more in terms of the big things like farmland and factories and, you know, tractors and 18-wheelers and stuff like that. Okay, and the power plants, that kind of stuff. Okay, so as far as this course, we just don't have time. In 10 weeks, you know, I just debated whether or not we could get into this, and I decided no. So what we're going to do in this course is we're going to focus on capitalism and the market economy, spend some time explaining to you how that works, And then we're going to jump right into the third category, which I'll talk about in a minute. And so we're just going to skip the section of the book talking about socialism. But I would recommend for you to read that stuff, because it's very useful, I would argue, and the historical treatment, some of you may have never heard those statistics before about how many people died under socialist regimes in the 20th century and that sort of thing. So again, we just don't have time to cover that, but the fact that I'm skipping it doesn't mean it's not important. It just means, you know, scarcity, trade-off. I had to pick something. Okay, so moving on, interventionism or the mixed economy, that is what most what exists in most places in the world today. It's in between those two extremes. Then on the one hand, you can imagine a pure market economy where there's in principle no government at all, and there's just all everything is owned privately by private owners, and you know, if a business is going to start, then there's an entrepreneur who comes along and has to get the agreement of all the people involved. Like if he wants to get workers, he's got to bargain with them and pay them enough to get them to agree to it. If he wants certain resources, he's got to pay the owners. If he wants to build a factory, he's got to buy the land or rent it and pay for the resources to build and all that stuff. That's and anybody can go into any occupation they want. That's what we mean by free enterprise. So that's, you can imagine that on one side. Then the other side is the pure extreme of pure socialism, where the government, in a sense, owns everything and just tells everybody what to do, and that's how the economy is organized. But in the real world, usually it's in between those two extremes. And that's what we could refer to as the system of interventionism, or what's called the mixed economy. So that's clearly what we have in the United States and in the European countries, but it's also basically what we have around the world. And it's just some systems are closer to socialism and some are closer to a market economy. So the defender of this third way, this middle ground, will say something like this. They'll say, look, there are problems. We all know that pure socialism doesn't work. We saw what happened in the Soviet Union. We can see how much of a basket case North Korea is. We see that Cuba is not working. So, okay, we all know historically socialism doesn't work. But on the other hand, they're going to say, we're a civilized people and we don't like the extremes of pure capitalism. Okay, because we had a very capitalist system in the 1800s in the United States, and we didn't like it. That there were kids working in factories, there were really rich people who kind of ran the show, and they controlled the banking system, and there were monopolies that were taken over, and you know, people, there were no regulations to make sure that products were safe, and the businessmen were just taking advantage of workers and of their customers. And so fortunately, we now have a government, a strong government that's come in there. Not that the government is going to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs, right? We still have a market economy with a lot of innovation and competition and stuff like that, but we have a social safety net. So we have the governments there to sort of dampen the excesses of raw capitalism. And so we sort of have the best of both worlds, that we have the innovation and the dynamism of a market economy, but we also have the social safety net there to take care of widows and orphans and sick people who don't have health insurance, and to protect workers' rights and that kind of stuff, and make, you know, protect rivers from polluting corporations. So we have all that stuff, which is what the socialists were dreaming up. So we have the best of both worlds. Okay, so that's the vision of a defender of this interventionist system, or what's called a mixed economy. So we're going to see, just to anticipate where we're going, once we teach the basic principles in economic analysis in the setting of a pure market economy, then in the last section of the course, we're going to start going through the mixed economy, and we'll go over a few of the more popular interventions, right? Ways that the government interferes with the outcome that would happen under a pure market. And I'm going to argue and try to convince you that far from improving on the market outcome, actually these interventions will make things worse, even from the point of view of the people who support the intervention. And so that far from combining the best of both worlds, all the intervention will do is like take the good market outcome and push it towards the bad socialist outcome, right? So that it's not that there's a happy medium, it's that the market outcome actually does a lot of what social reformers think would be the good thing, and that if you deviate from that and move towards socialism, you're just hurting the very people you think you're helping, right? So again, we'll discuss that though in greater detail later on in the course, but that's the approach we're going to take. Okay, so moving on, in today's lecture, let me just see how we're doing on time here. Okay. So direct exchange. So here, let me motivate this. So in the last class, we talked about Robinson Crusoe, and we saw, excuse me, and we saw that Crusoe could improve his condition by exchanging with nature, if you will, right? That he could give up some of his leisure and work and then take the physical resources, the natural resources at his disposal, and turn them into either consumption goods, or he could turn them into capital goods, which would then augment his labor in the future so that his income would be higher. You know, through savings and investment, he ends up being able to consume more permanently. And so that shows you the benefits of action just on an individual level and in the context of having natural resources at your disposal and having some theories about what you could do with those resources. But then when we get into a social context where there's more people now and there's property rights, well, now the issue is, I mean, you're still technically doing the same thing. You're trying to say, what are the options at my disposal and what can I do to improve my situation as I perceive it subjectively? But now, because there are other people involved, and we're assuming for our purposes right now that it's in the institutional setting of a pure market economy, well, now if you want to be able to use any of the resources or the goods that happen to be owned by other people, you have to get their agreement. And so that's where direct exchange comes in. So in a direct exchange, it's very simple that you're giving up property that you are the legal owner of and somebody else is doing the same. And it's voluntary. That's what we mean by a direct exchange. All right, so the first most basic observation to make is that to the extent that an exchange is voluntary, then it's a win-win situation. That both parties to the exchange walk away thinking they got the better end of the deal. And that's a very elementary insight or observation, and yet it's also profound, because historically, that was a stumbling block to people, to thinkers of the caliber of Aristotle. Right? So Aristotle, when he was analyzing market exchanges, I don't remember of course he didn't say it in English, but even the translation, I can't remember the exact wording they use, but he was saying things to the effect that if two people make a trade, in order for that to be just, for one party to have not taken advantage of the other party, we need it so that the things they traded should be of equal value. Right? Because he was thinking, you know, if one person gives up something that was really worth a lot more than the other thing, then the person who got the thing that was worth a lot more, you know, took advantage of or, you know, somehow injured the interests of the other party. Well, strictly speaking, if that's how you're approaching the market economy, at least from our perspective now as modern subjective value theorists, you're not going to get anywhere. Because if you think about it, if you're saying the only way a trade can be justified is if the parties are giving up and getting something of equal value, well, then why are we wasting our time trading? Why would you give up something to get something that you thought was equally valuable? That's pointless. That in every trade, what actually happens is, so long as it's voluntary, each party gives up something and gets something in return that they think is more valuable than the thing they gave up. And that's why they agreed to the trade in the first place, because they saw that there was an advantage in doing so. So what's happening here, and the thing that tripped up Aristotle and the people following in that tradition, is they were thinking of value as an objective quality of the goods. So like a good would have a certain amount of value in the same way that it would have a certain weight, or that it would have a certain color, or a certain odor. And so if that's the way you're thinking, that value resides in physical objects, well then yeah, you can, then it would be natural to say, well, it's not fair if somebody gives up something that's more valuable and gets something that's less valuable. But the point with modern theory, again, that was really developed fully by Karl Menger and people in that line, is to start with the observation that no, value isn't in physical things, it's in your mind. That value really is in the, not so much the eye of the beholder, but the mind of the beholder. And so because different people can ascribe different values to the same physical thing, that's how it's possible that both parties in the exchange can walk away happier. So two little kids at lunch, the one kid, you know, has had a banana the last 5 days and he's sick of them, and that girl has had an apple the last 5 days and she can't stand to see the sight of another apple. They say, "Do you want to trade?" And they both think they walked away with the better fruit, and they're both right. Okay, whereas if value were something that was intrinsic to the objects, just like weight or something, then that would be impossible. So it can't be the case, for example, that both kids trade their lunch, the lunches that their moms pack for them, and that both kids walk away with the lunch that has more calories. That's impossible. No, because one of the lunches has more calories than the other, or they could both have the exact same. But it can't be the case that they both walk away with lunches that had more calories than the lunch they gave up. That's impossible, because calories is a physical thing, you know, that's objective. It's inherent in the food. But it is possible that they both walk away with the lunches that are more valuable, because value is in their heads. Okay, moving on. Direct versus indirect exchange. And I should say also, if you want to read more on that, if you go to Mises.org today, actually it was yesterday, I think, I have an article up there for the daily article about subjective value and objective market prices or something like that. So that's written at a little bit higher level than your textbook's written at, but if you're an overachiever and you wanted more from what the textbook gave, you can go there and look that up. So again, it would have been on Monday's article at Mises.org, the daily articles. Okay, direct versus indirect exchange. Here I just want to make another distinction that we'll pick up on next week's lecture. All right, so this week we're going to talk about direct exchange. Next week we're going to talk about indirect exchange. And so right now I'm just introducing this distinction for you. So what the distinction is that in a direct exchange, both parties directly value the thing that they're getting, meaning they intend to use it. Okay, so as opposed to if you're getting something that you're not going to use yourself, and that you only value it because you are planning on trading it away in the future. So the most obvious example of an indirect exchange is one that involves money. So if you buy something with money, that's an indirect exchange, because the person selling it, so let's say your friend has a DVD that they don't want anymore, and you buy it for $10, and you give the person a $10 bill, that's an indirect exchange, probably, because chances are the person who's getting that $10 bill isn't going to directly use it either to consume or to make something with it. That what the person selling that DVD has in mind for that $10 bill is to just hold on to it and then trade it away to somebody else in the future. They don't have to have the specific person in mind, But the point is that when you say to them, hey, I'll give you this $10 bill for that DVD, they're not thinking, oh, wow, that's a really handsome piece of art. I think I'll just put that on the thumbtack up on my wall and just look at that thing. And they're not thinking, oh, I could use that. That'd be a great bookmark. I could use that thing. No, they're thinking, oh, that green piece of paper satisfies the legal requirements of currency in our current system, and I could go and use that to get other stuff that I might want down the road. And so, yeah, that's with my expectations of the sorts of things I could get for that green piece of paper, I will certainly give up my DVD for that. And then, so now I'm better off. That the subjective value I'm placing on the expectation of the sorts of things I can probably get for this green piece of paper, I value that more than the happiness or whatever I was getting from continuing to hold this DVD. So that's why it's a voluntary trade, but it's an indirect trade, it's an indirect exchange, because again, I'm going to use that green piece of paper to go get something else. So it's like, in a sense, when you buy something, when you sell something for money, you're going through the money. That you're selling something, getting the money, and then buying something with the money. So it's like, in the grand scheme, you traded away your DVD in order to go buy the lunch. And so it's really like you gave up the DVD in exchange for the lunch, and that green piece of paper was sort of like the middleman. That was just the what's called a medium of exchange, sort of like a placeholder, if you will. Okay, so again, we'll get into that more in next week's lecture. But let me just make sure you understand what direct exchange is. So direct exchange means every other type of exchange where the thing you're getting in the process of the exchange, you plan on using personally. Now be careful, it doesn't mean, it can be a production good, okay, or a producer good. So you can, if let's say there's two farmers, and the one farmer is really hungry, and he wants, so his neighbor has a bunch of eggs that the chickens just laid, and so this farmer's thinking, oh yeah, I could use those to make an omelet, and so I'm going to directly consume those eggs, or maybe he's even going to be like Rocky and just put them in the blender and make a disgusting shake. All right, so he's planning on consuming those eggs. So in his mind, they're consumption goods. And he says to the other guy, so in trade here, I'll give you this axe for 100 of your eggs. All right, and the other farmer's thinking, oh yeah, I could use that axe. Now what's he going to use the axe for? He's not going to eat it. He's not going to wear it as a hat. He's not going to put it up on his wall as a piece of art. No, he's going to use it to, let's say, go start cutting down trees to maybe build a fence around his property or who knows what. All right, so that if that trade goes through, that is a direct exchange, even though the one farmer who took the axe, you might be thinking, oh, he's indirectly valuing it, because it's not like he gets direct happiness from the axe. He's only getting happiness from the things that he can do with it. Right, so yes, the axe is not a consumption good, the way we defined it last time, but the axe is it's a production good or a capital good. But the point is, in terms of the distinction between direct and indirect exchange, just be careful, it's still a direct exchange because he's planning on using the axe himself. He's not just taking the axe thinking, I bet you Farmer John over the next two hills would really like this axe, and I bet you I could get a cow for it, and I really want a cow, so that's why I'm taking this to go give it to... That would be an indirect exchange. But no, if you're planning on using the axe yourself, then it's a direct exchange. Okay, so for the remainder of time, let me just get my bearings here. So we started at 45, so 45... Okay. With the remainder of the time here, let me just walk you through the candy example that was at the end of the book. So again, there a few people trickled in here after we started. So these are the sorts of diagrams I'm going to be looking at. So if you have your physical textbook, go ahead and open that. It's around page 86, something like that. If you don't have the physical textbook, just scroll through the public chat And look, okay, thanks, Paul. Paul just posted it again. That's the URL you can go to get your hands on the PDF of this, that it's going to be easier for you to be looking at these things in a bigger version than what I'm going to be going over. So let me just double check here and see how much time we got. The reason I'm doing this is because there's a class after us, so I got to make sure that we shut the room down so the next guy can come in. Okay, so yeah, we have to totally be over at 15 minutes after. So I will do this for, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'll answer your questions that you have on this stuff. Okay, so and I'm going to pull up the PDF as well. Okay, so what we're looking at here is Alice's preference rankings for various combinations of Snickers and Milky Ways. So what this is, let me just walk you through and make sure you understand, first of all, the big picture and then what I'm doing with these charts. So here, I just told you the general picture of what a direct exchange is, and I hinted at how next week we're going to get into indirect exchange, and that's ultimately how we're going to start talking about money. So clearly, where are we going with this? We want to be able to explain money prices in a modern market economy. But the strategy we're using is we're starting really simple. So last week we just talked about a guy all by himself on a tropical island. So there's no money there, obviously, because there's nobody to trade with. But now instead of jumping from that into one person with a million other people buying and selling things for money, well, that's too big of a jump. It's easier conceptually if we first say, now let's have two people, and they're not using money, they're just doing direct exchanges. They're just trading things that they directly value. Okay, so that's the next increment in terms of the complexity. And so we're going to study this scenario first, and then once we get some more principles down, then next week it'll make more sense to pick up or, you know, step it up a notch so that it's more complicated but yet closer to what we do in the real world. Okay, so that's the big picture. We're trying to explain how can prices be formed in a barter situation. And by barter, I mean where there's no money, where people are just trading things directly against each other. So what I'm trying to get you to see here is that we, first of all, realize that we can explain this. So that might be something interesting to you that I'm going to show you, and the reason I went through and made these specific numerical examples is just to show you that economists really can explain the formation of market prices. So it's not just a sort of vague general explanation. I mean, if we knew all this information, we could tell you a lot about what the market price would be, at least after things had settled down a little bit, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But the point is, you might be surprised at how much we actually can say about this just using the general principles and reasoning through and trying to say, what are these people trying to accomplish? You can actually say a lot about what the prices are going to be. One other thing before we jump into this specific example is, what do I mean by the price? Well, the market price is simply the exchange ratio of goods against each other. So clearly, you're used to a price being a certain amount of money. Then you say, oh, how much does that car cost? Oh, it costs $5,000. Or if you're in Europe, you know, say, how much does that car cost? Maybe it costs 3,000 euros. But what's the general principle there? It's saying, how many units of the one good do I have to get up to get one unit of the thing I want to buy? That's what we mean by a money price. So what I'm saying now is that concept of price is more general. You can talk about prices even if you're not using money. The price would just mean, how many units of the thing I have do I have to get up to acquire one unit of the other thing? And when we say acquire in this setting, we mean getting an existing owner to voluntarily transfer ownership to me. So that's the way now that we're acquiring things in the setting of trade. Because remember, Crusoe, in a sense, was trading with nature, but if Crusoe wanted more coconuts, what he was having to give up was his leisure. He had to go climb a tree, or he had to go build a pole and knock it down. Whereas another way in a modern economy where there's property rights, another way of getting something you want, if somebody else owns it, is to offer to give up some of your property for it. And that's a different route to acquiring things you want. And so that's what we're studying here. We're trying to figure out general principles for what determines the exchange rate or the price at which people are going to voluntarily start trading their property. So that's the big picture. That's what we're trying to focus on here. And I'm just trying to outline some of the general principles. Okay, so Alice's preference ranking for various combinations of Snickers and Milky Way. So the setting here is that there's these kids that went out for trick-or-treating on Halloween and came back with a bunch of candy, and now they have a bunch of Snickers and Milky Ways, and we're just going to see what would regulate, or what kind of principles can we discuss to explain the prices at which they would trade with each other. So let me explain to you, make sure you know how to read these charts, because once you understand how to read these things, it's actually, the rest of the analysis is pretty straightforward, but there's a lot of information packed into these charts or these tables. So first of all, what this is ranking, this is not physical. There aren't these different combinations that physically exist. This stuff, this is 25 different possible combinations, and we're basically asking Alice in her mind to imagine all these different combinations, and then asking her, of these 25 possible combinations, which would you prefer the most? What would be the best combination as far as you're concerned? And so we see that that's the 4 Snickers and 4 Milky Ways. Let me also say to you guys, the reason it caps out at 4 is just because I wanted to keep it manageable, right? If we ask Sally, in a perfect world, would you want to have 10 Snickers and 10 Milky Ways, she'd probably say, yeah. But I didn't want to deal with that possibility, because then we would have a list that was way too long to fit on a page. So that's why I just sort of arbitrarily capped it at 4 apiece, so that now there's only 25 possible combinations. All right, so that's the thing she wants the most. So that number 1 is saying, like, first. That's like saying that's her best thing. That's the first place thing. And then the number 2 is saying the second ranked thing. And you can see that's 4 Snickers and 3 Milky Ways and so on. All right, so the way you read this thing, the right-hand side, is just the S, the number in the S refers to how many Snickers, and the number in the M refers to how many Milky Ways. So just looking at this, I made this particular ranking obey some rules or some patterns, just to make sure you understood the general logic. In the real world, people can have any preferences they want. There's nothing saying you have to rank things like this, or else you're irrational or something. People do whatever they want. But my point is, I made these obey a certain pattern when I was generating these numbers, just to make it easier for you guys to sort of get the general idea. So one obvious observation you can make is that Alice prefers more candy to less. That for any possible combination you can think of, if you bump up either of the numbers, then the new combination is going to be higher on the list than the original one. And so that's why, you know, 0-0 is at the bottom and 4-4 is at the top. But even in between those extremes, that rule I just said is going to be true. Like, for example, if you pick 2S and 1M, which is at the 14th rank, and then you'd say to Alice, okay, suppose right now, you know, you could say to Alice, would you rather have 2 Snickers and 1 Milky Way, or would you rather have 3 Snickers and 1 Milky Way? We know she would rather have the 3 Snickers and 1 Milky Way. And so how would you know that looking at this list? You would say, well, the 2S, 1M was at the 14th rank, whereas the 3S and the 1M is 2 notches higher, the 12th rank. And so the 12th is better than the 14th, and that's why she would say, I want the 3 Snickers and the 1 Milky Way. And so, or going the other way, if we had 2 Snickers and 1 Milky Way, that 14th ranked as the starting point, and then I said to her, okay, do you want that, or would you prefer to have 2 Snickers and 2 Milky Ways? So now I've added at 1 to the n. Now you got to find 2 on that list, and that's up at 11. Okay, so that that general rule is going to hold. Whatever she starts out with, if you offer more of either or of both, so you're just bumping up one or both numbers, that new combination is going to be higher on her ranking. So that's one general rule that this ranking follows. Another one is that she, loosely speaking, likes variety. So that, it's kind of hard for me to spell exactly what I mean by that, but if you just look at the pattern, you can see that, for example, if she starts out with, I can give you an example. Let's say she starts out with one Snickers and one Milky Way, and so that's at the seventh ranked thing, and you say, okay, do you want another Snickers or do you want another Milky Way? How would you answer that question? You would say, well, what about, does 2S and 1M rank higher than this thing? And yes, it does. 2S and 1M are at the 14th rank, and that's higher than the 17th rank. But then you'd say, okay, what about 1S and 2M? Yep, that also ranks higher. That's at 15th. But of those two that I just said, the 2S and the 1M is higher than the other one. Okay, so the point is, if she starts out with 1S and 1M, and then you offered her, do you want a Snickers or do you want a Milky Way? In addition, the way you would answer that is you'd have to update and see what the new bundle is under either scenario, and then where does it rank? Okay, so we can answer she would prefer the Snickers. All right, and that's actually another rule that this follows, is that Alice, in a certain sense, likes Snickers more than Milky Ways. Okay, but my point is that interacts with the other principle, which is that she also likes variety. And so those things sometimes contradict each other. So again, just backing up, let me make sure I'm not losing anybody. In general, she likes more candy. She prefers more candy to less candy. So for any starting combination, if you bump up either of the numbers or both, she's always going to want that thing more than the first combination. Another sort of general thing is that you could say other things equal, she likes Snickers more than Milky Ways. That for looking at the same numbers, if you were going to switch them, she would want the bigger number to be on the Snickers side rather than the Milky Way side. So if you say, would you want to have one and two or two and one, she's going to want the two and one as compared to the one and two. Or, you know, 3 and 1 versus 1 and 3, she's going to want the 3 and 1. Right? So that's another rule that this ranking obeys, if you want to look at that. And that's sort of capturing the idea that Alice likes Snickers more than Milky Ways. But however, it's not true. You can't conclude from that no matter what, if you said to Alice, I'm going to give you one more candy bar, do you want me to give you a Snickers or do you want me to give you a Milky Way? You don't know that she's always going to want the Snickers, even though there's a sense in which she kind of likes Snickers more, because if she starts out in a situation where she's got a lot of Snickers, then she might want, if all she gets to choose is between one more of either bar, she might pick the Milky Way. Okay, and just to give you an example, let's say she starts, let's say she's at the 12th position. Okay, so she's at 3 Snickers and 1 Milky Way. So now you ask Alice, we're going to give you one more candy bar, either Snickers or Milky Way. Which one do you want? The way you would answer for her, the way you'd get inside her head, is you'd say, okay, starting at 3S and 1M, let's first test where would she end up if we gave her one more Snickers. Well, she'd end up at 4S and 1M, right? And so that's up at the 9th position. So that she's clearly better, she wants to get more, but now you say, what if instead of that she took a Milky Way? Well, then she'd end up at 3S and 2M, and you can see that's way up at the 7th position. So either one makes her better off, but if she has to choose, she's going to say, give me the Milky Way, because that's the way she gets to the highest possible bundle or combination, given what the constraints are. Okay, So again, the point of that whole thing, little demonstration, is to say that even though there's a sense in which her friends or her mom might say that Alice likes Snickers more than Milky Way, you can't always conclude that no matter what her situation is, if you offer her either bar, she's always going to pick the Snickers. Because if she's already loaded up with Snickers, she might choose the Milky Way, and you know, you could explain that intuitively by saying she likes variety. Okay? So that's the, and that's just the idea of marginal utility. That's like the water diamond paradox. That you could say, in a sense, I prefer having more water to diamonds, because if I started out with nothing and I was about to die of thirst, I would certainly take the water over the diamonds. But you can't conclude from that that I would always pick water over diamonds, because if we're in a situation like we are in most cases where you have a lot of water at your disposal and only a few diamonds, you might pick the diamonds. Okay, so now why don't we go ahead and move on. Okay, now that I spent a long time explaining the basic layout of that thing, this part should actually be fairly quick. Okay, so now what am I doing in this chart, this diagram? Now we're bringing her brother Billy into the picture. And for simplicity, just to make sure we're isolating the effect that starting out with a different combination has, I made Billy's rankings an identical copy of Alice's. So just to be clear, make sure you're not getting lost there, that's unrealistic in general, especially once we start ranking all sorts of things, not just two candy bars. In general, people are going to have unique preferences. Everyone's list of how they value things is going to be different. But in this case, I made them the same because I want to focus on how what they start out with can influence the price. Okay, so that's, so again, I'm just changing one thing at a time. I don't want to totally change the situation. And so that's why I'm keeping Billy's ranking to be a carbon copy of Alice's, to just isolate that one difference and how it affects things. Okay, so now looking at this, we have different color combinations here. So the black, the things that are colored in black, as you can see, the key is in the middle, and that's saying those are the initial combinations. So the idea is Alice and Billy come to the table with different things. Alice walks in and she starts out with four Snickers bar and no Milky Ways. Billy comes in with zero Snickers and four Milky Ways, right? So those are the black things, and that's where they start out with. And now we want to see, are there gains from trade? Can these kids both walk away happier with the new combination after they've traded some or all of their property? Is it possible they can walk away from the table and both kids prefer the thing they walk away with to what they came to the table with in the first place? All right, and we're going to see that, yeah, there's lots of different possibilities where that's going to be true. And so that's what we mean by saying there are gains from trade. There is a way to rearrange the ownership of the physical candy bars, right? Because these kids aren't making more candy bars. All they're doing is rearranging the ownership of the candy bars, and yet they're both going to be happier when all is said and done. They're both going to prefer living in the world where the ownership rights have been adjusted. So that's a way to think about what happens in a voluntary trade, is that two people agree to rearrange, legally speaking, who owns what, and they're both happier. And that's a way in which we see that exchange makes the world a better place in that sense. Okay, so how do we know there's gains from trade? The angle of approach that I'm going to take is, rather than me trying to just directly tackle and say what's the price going to be, I'm trying to show you that if we just assume different prices, we can test and see, would this price work? You know, could the kids trade at this price? Could they both be happier? And would it be sort of like a stable outcome? And we're going to see that, yeah, with two kids with these preferences and what they start out with, that there are a few different prices that could do the trick. So the easiest one is, let's assume they trade one for one. So the first thing we want to check is that are there gains from trade at that price? So that one Snicker bar trades for one Milky Way. So the way you would check that is, you say, okay, let's look at from Alice's point of view first. We'll check her first. Would she be willing to give up one of her Snickers bars to acquire one Milky Way? So she starts at 4S and 0M, that black thing on the left column, and then if she gave up one Snicker to gain one M, one Milky Way, that means she would go from 4S, 0M, her combination would be transformed into 3S and 1M. So you got to find that on the list. Where is that? Oh, that's way up there in position 12, 3S and 1M. So yes, Alice would be happier with that bundle or that combination than with what she started with. So that's the same thing as saying she would agree to giving up one Snickers to acquire one Milky Way. We do the same thing for Billy. Would he want to go from 0S and 4M up to 1S, 3M? Yes, he would, because you can see that's 13th on his ranking as opposed to 18th. Okay, so they would both be happier if Sally gave Billy one of her Snickers and he gave her one of his Milky Ways. But you don't stop there. Then you say, would they do it again? And you can see, yeah, they would. That Sally now, if she's a 3S and 1M, would she want to go to 2S and 2M? In other words, giving up one more. And yes, she would, because she'd move from the 12th spot, boom, up to the 11th. Billy, the same sort of thing. If he did one more, he would go from the 1S, 3M up two more notches to 2S, 2M. Okay, so they would both end up in the 11th ranked position, which is not only better than the initial, but it's also better than the intermediate step. Okay, so again, just to review, Sally would be better off giving up one Snicker for 1M, and then she'd get better off again giving up a second Snickers to acquire a second M. Now, let's just check one more. Would they want to do it a third time? Check from Sally's point of view first. So right now, she's at two Snickers and two Milky Ways. Would she want to give up a third of her original Snickers to get a third Milky Way? So that would bring her, that would make her new result be 1S and 3M, but no, she wouldn't, because that would bump her down to the 13th position, whereas right now she's tentatively at the 11th position. Okay, so we could say, no, after, if the price ratio is one Snicker bar trades for one Milky Way, Sally would want to sell two Snickers and buy two Milky Ways. But she wouldn't want to sell a third Snicker to buy a third Milky Way. She would stop after doing two trades, or you could think of it as one trade doing two bars at a time. And then you can also check with Billy, it's the same thing, that after two, he wouldn't want to do any more. Okay? So that's how we conclude. That's what we mean when we say it would be stable, or you could say there would be an equilibrium outcome of a price of one Snicker bar for one Milky Way. And under that price, the kids would trade so that Sally would give up two Snickers and Billy would give up two Milky Ways, and they would end up having two of each. Okay, so again, we're just rearranging who owns what, and they're both better off than what they started out with. All right, so that's how you do that case, and that's what that gray line is showing you. Okay, let me just, because we're under time constraints here, let me just do one other one. And then we'll move on to the next slide. So another one would be, what's colored sort of dark gray? What if we said the price would be, what about two Snicker bars for one Milky Way? Okay, so just make sure you follow the logic of the argument here. We don't have enough information. I can't tell you what the price is going to be using these principles. What I'm showing you is various prices that would work, prices that would lead to an equilibrium, like a stable resting point, where there are trades that occur, and then people settle down, and then they want to stop trading, and we could say, all right, what was the price at which those trades happened? That's what I'm doing right here, is I'm showing you there are several possibilities given this information. So we just saw one outcome could be that one Snicker bar trades for one Milky Way, and at that price, there's going to be, you know, two Snickers are going to trade for two Milky Ways, and that's it. Now I'm going to say, could it be that the kids trade, and then we as the economists look at what just happened, and we realized, we observed that the price was Alice had to give up 2 Snicker bars to acquire 1 Milky Way, and we're going to see, yeah, that is possible. So let's just check that case quickly, and then we'll move on to the next slide. So from Alice's point of view, would she, if Billy comes along and says, hey, I propose I will give you 1 of my Milky Way bars, but I want to get 2 of your Snickers, take it or leave it, what do you want to do? Sally would be better off if she agreed to that. You know, if she really thinks that that's the offer, that take it or leave it, she's going to say, well, right now I have 4S and 0M. If I gave up 2 Snickers to just acquire 1 Milky Way bar, that would leave me with 2S and 1M, and that's the 14th ranked position. So it's better for me, according to my preferences, to be at the 14th rather than the 16th position. So yeah, I'd agree to that. And then from Billy's point of view, would that be a good deal for him? Well, yeah, of course it would. He would jump from 0S to 4M all the way up to 2S and 3M, right? Because he gets 2 Snickers and only has to give up 1 Milky Way. So he goes from the 18th all the way up to the 8th position. So he clearly would be happy doing that. All right, and then you could check again and say, would Sally want to do it again? Would she want to give up her remaining 2 Snickers to acquire a second Milky Way? Well, no, she wouldn't, because then she would end up with 0S and 2M, and that is, where is that? That's way down in the 22nd position. Okay, so she would do it once, you know, starting with 4 Snicker bars. She would pay the kind of high price of giving up 2 of them to get 1 Milky Way. She would do it once, but she wouldn't want to do it again. And as far as Billy, let me check. This one might be a little quirky. Would he have wanted to do it again if Sally were willing? That would mean he would go to 4S and what, 1M? No, 4S and 2M. Yeah, he actually would want to do it again, and so that would put him up in the 5th ranked position. So this is a little bit of an ambiguous case if you want to say, is this really an equilibrium outcome? Because technically, at that price ratio, Billy would want to do it at least twice, but Sally only wants to do it once. All right, so there I'm labeling that would work, because Billy would clearly be happy to at least accommodate Alice for the trade she wanted to do, but technically it's a little bit, you know, to have a nice clean outcome, you would want it so that everybody didn't want to trade anymore at the official price, like we had in the first example. So there, I'm just mentioning that little complication. But the general principle you should see, if the price were 2 Snicker bars for 1 Milky Way, they could do it at least once, where Sally, in a sense, sells 2 Snickers and buys 1 Milky Way, whereas Billy sells 1 Milky Way and buys 2 Snickers. And so make sure you understand how you would use the language of buying and selling in this context, and that's where they would end up. Okay, and then you can run through the other scenarios. So now let me, because we're kind of running out of time here, let me hurry up and give you this last thing. So now what I'm trying to show you is, we've seen with 2 people, even with identical preferences, the fact that they start out with different combinations leads to a whole host of possibilities. And there were lots of different prices that could lead to gains from trade. And so if that's all the information we had to work with, and somebody says, hey, I want you to tell me what's the equilibrium price ratio, we're going to have to say as economists, well, if the only assumptions you're allowing me to make are that people are going to make voluntary trades, then I can't give you the price. I can just tell you there's a bunch of potential prices that might work or that could work if the kids ended up doing that, but I can't tell you more than that. In practice, in the real world, you usually don't have that kind of ambiguity, because the more people who enter the market, you sort of narrow the range of possibilities. That as you add more and more people, generally speaking, that's going to knock out some of the potential prices that would have worked with just 2 people or with fewer people. Okay, so that's the point of me bringing Christy in here, is to show you how that works. So the idea is, this diagram now, this last thing that we're looking at, has the original stuff with Alice and Billy and all the different color combinations. And now I'm bringing in Christy, and I'm going to show you the presence of Christy with the stuff she starts out with and what she wants to do to make herself better off. We're going to start crossing out some of the prices that would have worked for Alice and Billy. So the idea is Christy is going to narrow the range of possible prices that might work. And so if you get how that happens, then you can see by extension, in general, we start adding more and more people to this market. It's going to pin down what the equilibrium price is going to be. All right, so here, let me just do one of these. So Christy comes in. Notice Christy has different preferences, that her ranking looks different from Alice's and Billy's. And you can see, and she also starts out with one Snicker bar and four Milky Way. So when Christy enters the market, we can rule out, for example, let's just rule out the one of one Snicker trading for one Milky Way. So the sort of light gray thing that would have worked with Alice and Billy. The point is that's no longer an equilibrium if Christy's on the scene. And the reason we knock it out is because, you know, sort of intuitively, Christy comes along and she sees, you know, Christy really wants to get Snicker bars. Because she's, first of all, she likes them in terms of the preferences, if you look at the pattern. But also, she's coming to the scene with one Snicker and four Milky Way. So she's really loaded up with Milky Way, so she's dying to use her Milky Ways to go buy some Snickers. And so if she sees Alice selling Snickers at a price of one Snicker for one Milky Way to Billy, Christy's going to say, whoa, 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 what are you doing? I'll give you two Milky Ways for one Snicker. Don't sell them at such a, you know, such a great bargain to Billy. I'll outbid him. And so that's the sense in which that price of one Snicker for one Milky Way can't be sustained with Christy on the scene, because she's going to say to Alice, don't do that. Don't sell at such a low price to Billy for one of your Snicker bars. I'll give you two Milky Ways. Okay, so that's the sense in which it's not going to work. Intuitively, what's happening is there's more Milky Ways entering the market. And so with the greater quantity of Milky Ways on the supply side, that's going to increase the amount of Milky Ways that end up getting offered for a given Snicker bar. I mean, that's the intuition behind it. All right, so that's the way. And then you can also see the price ratio, the dark gray, where two Snickers trades for one Milky Way, for sure that's not going to last, because that's even worse from Alice's point of view. So the idea is Alice now is sitting pretty because she has the Snickers, which are much scarcer now compared to Milky Ways, when Christy shows up bringing an additional one Snicker bar, but an additional four Milky Ways. So now in this new, with the three kids in the mix, Snickers are more valuable in a sense in terms of the market, because there's more Milky Ways chasing the, just a little bit more Snicker bars. That's the idea. All right, well, why don't I stop there? We've only got about 4 minutes left. Like I said, we have to close down at 15 after, because I think there might be another class coming and I don't want to mess up their schedule. Okay, since there's like 22 of you in here, so I think it's fine if you guys have any questions right now, if you just want to post them right here in the public chat and I'll just answer them right here. Well, while you guys are thinking about that, if anyone has a question, we've got time for one basically. Let me just say one other thing about this. I don't want to give you the impression that this is not a mechanical determination. So even though the things that I'm talking about here, we can't actually say, oh, it's going to be one of these outcomes for sure. For example, it's possible, if we just look back, you know, forget Christy coming on the scene. Just looking at Alice and Billy here in the second to last slide, we can't even conclude that in the real world, even if we knew, which we wouldn't, but even if you grant that we knew the rankings of Alice and Billy, and we knew what they started out with, and we say, let's take Alice and Billy and lock them in a room, and then they come out a half an hour later and we say, okay, what trades did you make? We can't be sure that it's going to be one of these boxes that we've colored in. We can't even say that much because it's possible that Billy, for example, says to Alice, I want, you know, I propose I give you one of my Milky Way bars and I want two Snickers, take it or leave it. And Alice says, no, I think you're bluffing. I propose that I give you one Snicker and you give me two Milky Ways, because Alice is looking at this diagram herself and she realizes that that's also a possible equilibrium outcome. And so maybe both kids just are staring each other down saying, no, no, I'm serious. I want two Snickers for one Milky Way, take it or leave it. And the other person says vice versa. And they say, no, I'm serious. Seriously, you know, if you don't take that, I'm walking out of here with my four candy bars and you're not getting anything. And if they both stick to their guns, it's possible the half hour goes by and, oh, sorry, and they walk out with no trade occurring. Okay, so what we mean when we say that's not an equilibrium outcome or that's not a stable outcome is that there are still gains from trade. If these kids with these preferences and this and the starting combinations of candy bars, if they bargain with each other and then can't come to an agreement and leave without having any trade occur, there's still gains from trade there. They could both be better off through various possible exchanges. So that's the sense in which we're going to say, you know, this situation has not ended. This isn't done yet. That it's not an equilibrium outcome. Whereas if they do trade, let's say, two for two, so now they both end up with two of each, there's a sense in which now there's no more gains from trade. That it's not a matter of bargaining at this point. There's no way to make one kid better off without making one kid worse off. Whereas if they don't trade at all, we can still make them both better off just by rearranging the stuff they both own. So that's, just make sure you realize that we're not saying that we know in the real world it would be one of these boxes. It might be neither of them. They might not be able to come to an agreement because they're driving a really hard bargain. So Rick, just one last question. We got to do it 30 seconds here. Says, can you discuss how to calculate exchange ratio principles? Okay, so he says, for example, 20 goods is 190 exchange ratios, but 8 items is 25. So the idea is you, for every good, it has to trade in principle against, under barter, trade against every other possible good. So if you have 20 goods, it's 20 goods, and then they could trade against, you know, how many unique rate prices are there going to be against 19 other things. So it's like 20 times 19, but then you probably would divide by 2. Because, like, if it's, you know, apples against oranges, and you know that that's 3-1, well, then you know that oranges against apples is 1-3. So, you know, so in terms of if there's 20 goods, how many numbers do you need to give me so that I can know all the relevant exchange ratios? It's 20 times 19, then divided by 2. Because you don't need to do 20 times 20, because you say, how many oranges trades against one orange? Well, it's always 1. Okay, so you don't do 20 times 20, but you need to know, take everything, you know, everything could be the first good, and then of the other 19, you need to know that trading against that, but then you automatically know the opposite, and so that's why you divide by 2. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, so the eight's not actually 25. So I agree with you, the 20 would be 190, but the 8, I think, would be 28, not 25. Right, because it would be 8 times 7 divided by 2, which is 4 times 7. Okay, so I got to go now, guys, because we got to get out of here. So thank you for accommodating my schedule, and we'll have the quiz, I think, posted by the normal time. Thanks.